All right. I think it's right about time. Hey, listen, if any of you guys know me personally, you know one of the things I'm notorious about is miscalculating time zones. So, it's pretty late in the evening here in Singapore. I could very well be on time. I hope I am, given the number of people on the phone right now. It certainly looks like I'm on time. Or, as often the case, I might be an hour early or an hour late, but I think I'm on time. Appreciate everybody joining us for this. And I guess I should actually say, apparently the slideshow feature is broken. I'm not entirely sure what's going on here. I just got a new computer, so I might not have the right software update, but we're still going to talk through everything. I'm kind of looking at slides and typical form. I have questions and answers and so forth. But before I get into that, I want to talk to you about a couple of things. I've been really out and about, you know, in the world lately, kind of back to my usual form. Been on a plane pretty much every other day lately, it seems like. And you know, in the last month, have been on 1, 2, 3, 4 continents. A whole lot of countries, a whole lot of cities, and I've seen a lot. And I think, you know, part of the thing that I always like to do is give you my impressions. It's hard to do that, and try and jam everything into, 500 words, which is, I always try and keep our notes articles pretty short because I understand everybody's time is valuable. But it's a hard thing to do to really try and give you the essence of what I really see kind of on the ground. And so I want to go through some of the places just I've been, even the last couple of days. It was just a week and a half ago, probably. I was in Europe. I was in Italy, meeting with a lot of people there. You know, despite the fact that they decided to include hookers and cocaine in their GDP figures, I didn't seem to notice a whole lot of a boost. Just if I could be honest with you, it was pretty catastrophic. There was a period we were driving around. I was in Florence. And I was driving around with a friend, and we were looking for a place to eat. I was staying in a hotel, a beautiful hotel, outside of Florence. And he had come over to the hotel and picked me up, and we were driving around a little town outside of Florence, and all the restaurants were closed. And after a while, I mean, we could not find an open restaurant. It wasn't like the city center of Florence where all the tourists were, right? This was like a real, Italian village, and all the restaurants were closed. And after a while, I looked at him, and I said, man, what's up with all the restaurants? He goes, oh yeah, no, they're closed. And I thought about it for a minute, and I'm like, oh, like for like a corporate function, they're all closed for private parties and stuff. And he goes, no, they're just closed. It's because they don't have enough business. It's not enough business anymore for a restaurant to be open for lunch, and that really tells you something about. What it is in Italy. I would say it's slowing down, but it never sped up. It never got to normal. And so, regardless of what the politicians and the central bankers say, and euro growth is picking up and all this sort of stuff. I mean, it's total and complete nonsense. In Thailand, I came to Thailand, I guess, a week and a half ago, maybe. Right, it was right after Italy. I spent a few days in Italy. I attended the second wedding ceremony of our friend Gregor from Silver Bullion. Certainly begs the question, who gets married twice to the same woman in 6 months? But it was just a continuation of a ceremony. I'm just giving him a hard time about it. So we got to attend that that ceremony, and then flew out to Asia, where I spent the last couple of weeks. Actually, one of the things that struck me about it before I even got to Asia, and I'll just tell you this, when I booked the airfare, and I'm pretty notorious for really taking a lot of control over my own airfare. It's something I don't like to outsource because most people really screw it up. Some of you guys have probably dealt with Trish, who is the only travel agent I really trust. And Trish is great, by the way. If you need a travel agent, I do recommend Trish. Like everything else, I don't get paid for saying that. She's a sweetheart, and she's been there for me for years, 24/7. Literally, I could ring her up in the middle of the night, her time, while I'm somewhere in, Botswana, which I have, and she'll get on Skype and talk to me and fix my problem. Anyhow, I booked this flight myself, and I booked it on Thai Airways, right? Thai Airways is the national carrier of Thailand. It's actually owned by the Ministry of Finance, you know, in Thailand. So the airfare from Rome to Bangkok was, I want to say it was about $4,000. And that was in first class, okay? So this was a three-cabin plane, and the first class ticket, at first I saw $4,000 and I thought, well, that's expensive. Is that, you know, is that premium economy? That seems kind of, you know, kind of pricey. I saw $4,000 for first class. First class on a long haul, if you, you know, if you tend to travel that way, you know, is probably $10,000, $12,000, $15,000. I never do it. I think it's a total ripoff. There's a lot of easy ways to get huge discounts on airfare, but this was just the list kind of ticket price. You know, for first class, not even business class, first class airfare between Rome and Thailand. I couldn't believe it. I mean, this is like a 70% discount off of the normal price. It was insane. I couldn't believe it. And I thought about it and I thought, you know, there must be, so this must be a glitch, right? What's going on here? And then I realized, oh, well, wait a minute. You know, Thailand, with my destination, is in the middle of a coup right now. Is they've imposed martial law. And Rome, where I'm coming from, is broke. You know, everybody in Italy's broke. The entire country is broke. So you got a broke country, you know, trying to fly to a country in the middle of in a coup. You know, they can't give those tickets away. So, and they were practically doing it. And that, you know, really kind of taught me a bit of a lesson about it before I even got on the ground. And once I got on the ground in Thailand, I was actually fairly surprised because I was expecting, you know, they said martial law has been imposed. And I had friends here telling me, you know, for a while they had this curfew where everything had to shut down at 10, 11 o'clock, I don't remember, which in, you know, a place like Bangkok is just, it's unheard of. I mean, you know, the Bangkok is an all-night town where, the interesting thing about Bangkok is it's impossible to hide from life in Thailand. I mean, you walk outside and there are literally millions and millions of people and it is in your face 24/7. It is impossible to hide from life 24 hours a day. And so they came in and said, no, we're going to have a curfew and everybody's got to go home. This was unheard of. Now all these places, I mean, you can't, you know, you can't spit in Thailand without hitting a 7-Eleven. That's the big thing in Thailand. These all-night, 24-hour 7-Elevens. And there are these guys who run the 7-Eleven, and they say, man, I've been running this 7-Eleven, you know, for 10 years. We've never closed. And suddenly the military comes in and tells us that we have to close. And I'm telling them, guys, I don't even know how to close. We've never locked the door. We've been open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week since we opened the store. We've never, ever closed the doors. We've never locked the doors. I don't even know where the key is. So it certainly, you know, created a few challenges for some folks. And I was expecting to see a lot of that. But when I showed up, I found that actually, this is just in total fairness and objectivity, you know, the martial law, you know, from what I thought it was going to be, was totally not existent. I was expecting, you know, tanks and armored personnel carriers and, you know, all this sort of thing running around on the streets and, you know, guys with fire hoses, you know, hosing down people that got out of line. I mean, all these sorts of things, you know, you see in pictures. Didn't see any of that. It was actually quite calm, probably the calmest it's been in Thailand for a long time. You know, the generals running the show, if you're not aware of the situation, Thailand had been in another state of emergency. They had, you know, political opposition groups out doing battle with other political opposition groups, calling for the ousting of Yingluck Shinawatra, who is the sitting prime minister. This happens all the time in Thailand. This is nothing new. It happens over and over and over again in Thailand. And so these generals came in and they basically took over the country and they said, we're putting a stop to this. We're tired of all this violence. And it was like a new sheriff in town. They put the smack down on a whole bunch of politicians who ordinarily have their hands out, you know, getting bribes and kickbacks and all sorts of things. And so far, it seems to have been actually favorably well received here. And they're supposed to be transitioning to some sort of an election. And it made me scratch my head because I really started to reconsider my views on it, because at first I looked at it and I said, oh, here we go, here's a coup. This part of the world military forces generally tend to be very powerful institutions. Of course, in next door to Thailand, in Myanmar, Burma, you know, the ruling military junta has been in charge for decades. It's very similar all across the region. You know, the military is a very powerful institution. You can't get anything done without, you know, greasing a few, you know, camouflage palms along the way. And in Thailand, I looked at it, I said, okay, that's definitely going to be a problem. I was a little surprised when I showed up because everything was very calm and pretty easygoing. But I started thinking about it. I thought, well, what do you really call a coup? That's really a coup of a coup of a coup of a coup of a coup. It's like every government in Thailand over the last couple of decades practically has been illegitimate, corrupt, and completely morally bankrupt. And so what happens is there's some morally bankrupt government in place, and then somebody else comes in and they have a coup and they kick those guys out, and then somebody else comes in and kicks those guys out, and somebody else comes in and kicks those guys out. It really starts to blur the lines when you get a place that's become so corrupted. It really blurs the lines between what really is a coup and what, you know, legitimate government is there anyhow. They seem to, you know, the country obviously makes the same mistakes over and over and over again. But I will just say again, objectively, things seem to actually be very calm in Thailand. The idea of martial law was non-existent, and you know, the coup that's in place is really nothing more than a coup of a coup of a coup. The problem for Thailand right now really has anything to do with its government. It's really about the economy. The economy is definitely slowing in Thailand. They passed this minimum wage law under Yingluck about a year or two ago, and it's really had disastrous consequences because Southeast Asia is a place that's known for having cheap labor, and you take away the cheap labor, and you've got big problems. Suddenly, you know, there have been entire factories in Thailand that have literally, over the last 2 years, as soon as they passed this law, they built an identical factory, literally shot for shot, brick for brick, in neighboring Cambodia, where the minimum wage laws, you know, they don't have those sorts of laws, at least anywhere near what they have in Thailand now. And so the cost of labor is so much cheaper in Cambodia. So they just repackaged everything, shipped it over to Cambodia. And so all these people in Thailand now lost their jobs. All these people in Cambodia now have jobs because the government in Thailand went and raised the minimum wage and essentially defeated the only competitive advantage that Thailand had, was cheap labor costs. And so you had these factories that literally, these manufacturers walked away from their factories. They didn't even bother selling them. They just walked away and they built identical factories in Cambodia and hired, you know, new work for. They moved over the management and basically just canned everybody else. You know, and so that's caused a lot of increasing unemployment. Of course, anytime you have increasing unemployment, you get increasing political turmoil. You get people out in the streets demanding change and so forth. And so there have been a lot of different things about, you know, raising subsidies and handouts and all those sorts of things. Obviously, all the sorts of stuff that doesn't really bode well. But the economy in Thailand is definitely slowing, and it's going to be problematic. And of course, the real pain won't even begin until the king dies. And then, you know, that's a really unpopular thing to say. But yeah, I mean, Thailand is going to have a real serious problem whenever the king dies. And it used to be some years ago, there were these rumors going around that the king was dead, and they just weren't saying anything about it because they knew it would throw the entire country into a fit of turmoil. You know, it's kind of funny, the joke among the expats is it's not so much the rumor that the king is dead, the rumor is that the king's still alive. That's how sure everybody is that he's pretty well on his last leg, you know, if even still around. The bright side to all this has really been a tremendous amount of volatility. I have friends in Bangkok that are actually day traders, and of course, if you're a trader, you know, volatility is a friend, and this whole situation has created a massive amount of volatility in Thailand, and there's people right now that are actually making a lot of money off of it. In Myanmar, again, massively impressive place. Growth rates there are just astronomical. I'm looking at some very interesting opportunities there, but it's still a bit early. But I mean, this is a place just in the same way that so much manufacturing capacity and all the manufacturing jobs move over into Cambodia. Cambodia is a small country. I mean, there's only a few million people in Cambodia. It's like 60 million people in Thailand, almost as many in Myanmar. So I have a feeling that a lot of that industry is probably going to end up moving into Myanmar simply because they have more resources in Myanmar. They have more labor. The labor's even cheaper than it is in Cambodia. They just don't have the capacity right now. They don't have the factories and so forth that they have in Cambodia. But I think that Myanmar really is the future manufacturing hub, not just in Southeast Asia, but probably in all of Asia in general. And I could see within the next 10, 15, 20 years, even if we want to go that far out, I could see Myanmar being the global low-end, lower-end manufacturers. Same thing, China became this place where, I mean, look, the Chinese have become too expensive. They can't manufacture socks anymore. It's just not going to happen. Expensive high-end electronics where you need inexpensive, highly skilled manufacturing labor, China's still a great place to be. But if you need just, low-end, cheap, easy stuff, China's become too expensive, and I think Myanmar is going to end up mopping up all of that because it is so incredibly cheap. And I think there's people out there that are giving serious look. I see there's so many more foreigners there than there ever used to be, expats running around, scoping out the opportunities. And it's really grown a lot. There's way more hotel rooms than there ever used to be. So they're starting to service that, that market. And, there's banks that are coming in. I mean, one of the fastest growing cities in the world is the capital city of Myanmar. Nobody's ever heard of it, but it's really one of the fastest growing cities in the world. It's really amazing what's taking place there. I've been investigating a few opportunities. There's nothing I can really tell you a whole lot about right now, but I'll be back again probably in August. If I don't have the chance to go back next week, I'll be back in Myanmar in August and definitely looking into it more. Singapore, where I am now, where I got here yesterday, had a lot of really great meetings. I always love being in Singapore. It's very intellectually stimulating because there's so many people here to see, so many things going on, so many people with a great ear to the ground in various industries. I mean, the things that private bankers tell me in Singapore, because I love dealing with the private bankers here, because they have their fingers in a lot of pies and their ears to the ground, a lot of different places and a lot of different industries. They're telling me, for example, now the biggest rush into Singapore right now is actually from Japanese customers, Japanese individuals, and even Japanese businesses. And they told me, though I'm not allowed to mention any names, that there are actually some very large household name Japanese companies that are starting to move massive portions of their funds into Singapore because they don't trust Japan, they don't trust the Japanese government, they don't trust the Japanese banking system. And it's kind of funny because in Japan, Japan has this, the government has this sense that their national pride will sort of take them through, whatever tough times they have in Japan. It's total nonsense. And I mean, national pride is only going to take you so far. They said, well, back in World War II, we told the Japanese people what was going to happen, and they went back into their homes and waited patiently for the bombs to be dropped and all these sorts of things. I mean, they think people is still just going to, there's a huge difference between, love of country and love of government, and the Japanese government is clearly conflating the two. And that's a big problem because if there are more and more Japanese moving vaster and vaster sums of money into Singapore, that's less money to be in Japan, less money to continue to plug all the holes in the Japanese government's debt and deficit and so forth. I mean, this is a government that has spent over 25% of its tax revenue just to pay interest, where they have to borrow more than 50% of their budget every year. It's a complete disaster. And, now all the people that used to go and mop up all of that excess, deficit spending, now they're leaving. And so that's a big deal. I mean, this is something that is only accelerating the collapse of Japan in particular. I would say in total objectivity, Singapore is also slowing. From a social perspective, we've talked about this a couple of times, but there's a big backlash against foreigners. It used to be a big conflict between, Indian and Malay Chinese. And now even sort of the Western foreigners are getting pulled into it. There's been a lot of weird stories of, let's say, misbehaving Westerners on the ground in Singapore. And there's been a lot of backlash and people saying, hey, kick these guys out. A couple of them actually have been very publicly and embarrassingly kicked out. I think they're obviously going to make it much harder now for foreigners to obtain residency. We've been talking about this for 5 years. I'm at the point where I'm about to say that I think that residency ship has sailed in Singapore. If you got in, when we first started talking about this a few years ago, then great. If you're thinking about residency in Singapore now, just only now considering it, it might be too late at this point because I think they're really trying to tighten it up there. couple interesting things. Just something I have to mention. A lot of people ask me about the Singapore Precious Metals Exchange. This is something that's got, you know, a little bit of press, and, you know, what is this exchange, and, you know, is this some official thing? It's not official at all. There's a guy who runs it. Has I'm not here to disparage anybody, but just here to tell you facts are facts. And while it sounds very official, the Singapore Precious Metals Exchange is not any kind of official commodities exchange, you know, marketplace. They have no deal with any, you know, government body. And as a matter of fact, they were apparently a little bit too enthusiastic about mentioning certain partnerships and deals with the Royal Canadian Mint, and they actually got a cease and desist letter from the Canadian government about this. That's just, again, my presentation of the facts, just to say that this is a private company that was just very recently started, and so I don't like things that sound official and kind of dupe people into thinking they're official, and that the, you know, that's some exchange that people should have to deal with. Those are the facts. One friend of mine told me this is something I have not investigated yet, but there is there's a company in Singapore. It is essentially it's a commodities and financial trading firm, and it's called Olam, OLAM. And a couple years back, they actually got acquired by essentially the government of Singapore. One of their sovereign wealth funds acquired Olam International. So they do one of the reasons it's interesting about it is they almost primarily specialize in agricultural products, food ingredients, and so forth. They do a lot of supply chain management, but quite a bit of commodities trading, particularly in the agricultural space. And of course, as somebody who's quite interested and active in the agricultural market, this is an interesting company that I've looked at. They have bonds, and the bonds are actually yielding. It's sad to say that a 5% yield is interesting, but in these days, 5% yield is actually fairly interesting. And they have that both in U.S. dollars and Singapore dollars, with relatively short terms, 3-4 year terms. They've got that. There's one that. It's a 2018 bond, so it's whatever 4 years from now. That's yielding over 5%, and that's in Singapore dollars. And again, this Olam International is owned essentially by the government of Singapore. So you've got a successful, it's an agricultural trading company that's yielding 5%. This is a bond again, so this is fixed income. This would be for cash that you might have just sitting on the shelf somewhere. It might be an interesting thing to consider. I have to dive into a little bit more. This is just something that a banker friend was telling me about a couple of days ago, so I thought I'd mention it before I dove into it any further, which we probably will, because I'm considering it for my own sort of excess savings right now, even though I really don't do bonds. But it's something I might consider just because of the short duration. Hong Kong. Just briefly, also slowing down. I mean, Singapore, the economy in Singapore is slowing down. In Thailand, slowing down. Hong Kong, slowing down. The United States just announced, almost 3% GDP decline on an annualized basis in the last quarter. I mean, this is China slowing down. Europe still slow. Hasn't even sped up. I mean, Rome, Italy, total disaster. I mean, all these countries. And we've talked about, of course, before I left Chile slowing down. Chile, United States, Europe, China, all over Southeast Asia slowing down. And yet inflation is picking up. We keep saying this over and over. I mean, this is when it gets interesting. This is when it starts to get interesting. Is now we have. We've got slowing growth. We even have contraction in certain places, and we have increased inflation. This is every validation that, a bunch of guys and gals sitting in a room making monetary policy decisions, trying to control literally millions and millions of variables in their sole discretion is just an absurd system. It's a completely absurd system. The Fed is at a point now, and central bankers everywhere in the world are at a point now where they have to make a very hard decision and say, well, we could either continue printing money and let inflation run even more wild, or we can curtail printing and let the economy tank even more, And now it's just a question of, heads you lose, tails you lose. So So it's just, again, Hong Kong slowing, Singapore slowing, Thailand slowing, all these places are slowing. Other thing I wanted to mention, briefly about Hong Kong as well. There's definitely been some noise made about Hong Kong banks and their exposure to China. I've looked into it myself. It's not something that, obviously any bank in Asia, and at this point it's getting to be where just about every bank in the world is going to have exposure to China, just so they have exposure to the United States, just as they have exposure to Europe. When you are the largest economies in the world combined, every bank is going to have exposure to you. I'm not sure it's anywhere near the point where it's problematic. The growth of Hong Kong banks' exposure to China, loans they've made into the mainland and so forth, has definitely been on the rise. I think the banks there have probably noticed that, seen what's going on in China, and are taking steps to curtail that and make sure that they have the appropriate reserves and so forth. I'm not extraordinarily concerned about it right now because the banks in Hong Kong tend to be extremely liquid, extremely well capitalized. But it is something that I'm continuing to look at. I mean, this in the environment that we're in, and I want to be very clear about this. There's no horse that you can bet on and just let it ride for years and years and years, having to constantly reassess it. I think in the environment that we're in, I mean, interest rates in Europe are now negative. You have all these economies that are slowing. Central bankers have no clue. They are adrift. They have no clue what's going on. This is not an environment where you can just be complacent. This is an environment where, just to be honest with you, again, I am constantly assessing and reassessing and reassessing. And so, the decisions that we make about where to place our capital, these are important decisions, and that was one of the reasons why I really wanted to come out with a real grand slam banking recommendation with the one in Bermuda to get something that was completely different, safe, and so forth. And we'll talk about that in a minute. I want to talk about FATCA because FATCA goes into effect in a couple of days. This is something that has been, we've been talking about for a long time. The provisions where the banks are supposed to sign up, all the banks are supposed to have signed up by now by July 1st. The provisions where all the banks are supposed to simultaneously know that every other bank, is or is not signed up for FATCA, that goes into effect on July 1st. And everybody is basically, everybody's terrified. They're totally clueless. I actually got a very interesting email from Trade and Development Bank in Mongolia, and this pretty much sums it up. I got an email from these guys. If you bank in Mongolia, you might have gotten an email from them as well. And they're saying, you have to send us all these forms, and you have to, and they basically summarized the law. And it was completely wrong. Their summary of the law, I was looking at it thinking, these guys have no idea what FATCA is. But realistically, nobody has any idea what FATCA is. The banks are basically scared to death, and all they know is that there's some big, big, bad, scary law that if they screw up and they don't comply, that the U.S. government's going to take 30% of their money. And that's all they know. Even banks in the U.S., and what a lot of my banker friends have been telling me is that their Nostro accounts, their corresponding bank accounts, in banking parlance they call these Vostro and Nostro accounts, these are primarily in places like, most of them are in New York, and one of the biggest ones is Bank of New York. And Bank of New York is, they almost specialize in these bank-to-bank, interbank corresponding account services. And they're saying that Bank of New York is now questioning a lot of charges. So if there's funds that come into the United States and funds that come out of the United States, Bank of New York is calling up the foreign bank and saying, hey, who is this American client? Why are they sending you, $25,000 and so forth? So now you got a bank in Singapore or Hong Kong has to answer Bank of New York and say, he's a customer of ours and all this. So it's, Bank of New York and the corresponding accounts in the U.S. have really actually stepped up their, their spy-like role. And are going and making these inquiries, mostly because they just don't even understand the regulations themselves. This is really, to me, this spells the end of the U.S. banking system. Far and away, this mean, it doesn't mean the U.S. banking system is going to collapse. It means that the U.S. banking system is no longer going to be the dominant banking system in the world. And if the U.S. banking system is not the dominant banking system in the world, that means that the dollar is also going to lose a lot of ground. It's already happening. These, you know, the people are really stepping up their use of Chinese banks or use of renminbi. It's happening now in Canada. The Canadians are stepping up their use. They want to. Canada wants to be the North American clearing center for the renminbi. London is just falling head over heels in bed with the Chinese to become, you know, the biggest non-Chinese renminbi trading center on the planet. And the growth rates in London for the renminbi trading are astronomical. What this ultimately means is that we're going to start seeing a whole lot more trade and settlement and reserve and so forth being done in renminbi as opposed to dollars. And so as that happened, people use the U.S. banking system less, they use the dollar less. It's basically the same story. It's just two sides of the same story. You know, you got people that are tired of the U.S. banking system. They say, okay, how do we fix this? How do we get rid of the U.S. banking system? Well, we just have to stop using the dollar. Well, what else can we use? It's super liquid and so forth. At this point, the only answer is the renminbi. And so all that means is that most of the, you know, the international funds, particularly regionally in Asia and trade, not only within Asia, but trade between Asia and many other countries is going to take place now through other banking systems outside of the United States. And so the U.S. has really shot itself in the foot, because when the U.S. banking system is no longer in the same demand that it is, people just stop using the dollar. The dollar becomes much less popular. And if they stop using the dollar, then suddenly they don't have any reason to hold dollars. They don't have any reason to buy bonds. And the whole thing starts unraveling very, very quickly. Who buys treasuries anymore? Who's going to buy treasuries anymore if they don't have to hold dollars? You know, the only option then is for the Fed to continue printing and printing and printing. And if they don't have anybody else to export the inflation to, where does that go? It stays in the United States. So this is a problem that's only going to get worse. And they're doing it to themselves on purpose. They're going out of their way to try as hard as they can to get people to stop using the U.S. banking system. It is completely and totally absurd. So all, you know, this goes into effect on July 1st. You know, we all have a front row seat to watch it. So just be ready for what happens over the next. It's gonna, you know, this is not something that's gonna happen overnight, but this is definitely something that's gonna unfold. We're gonna see it before our very eyes over the next couple of years. Boy, I gotta get moving to questions here. Quick review on the month. We talked about Cartagena in Colombia, very exciting real estate prospects. I mentioned silver bullion discount. We'll have more from Silver Bullion. I was actually just with Gregor yesterday touring their new safe house facility. There's a, I would say, rather obscene video of Gregor and I, mostly because my hair looks ridiculous, and you'll see I got a black eye. I had a heinous gym accident the other day. So you guys will get to see that. But really interesting stuff. I wanted to give you an inside tour of this new facility, because it is because of the safe house that if you essentially, if you want to hold gold in Singapore now, you'll be able to do that, and it'll be non-reportable if you're a U.S. taxpayer. So that's a huge development. Bermuda banking, I was extremely pleased making this contact and bringing this contact to you. I've been in touch with the bank fairly regularly. We've had a lot of people write us and say, wow, they got a hold of me, and I've been delighted. Kamala is super cool. I really love the staff there. And I'm pleased with the account. It's been very straightforward. Other people have said, hey, I haven't heard from these people yet. All I can tell you is please be patient. In the write-up, it's a relatively small bank. They've got about $600 million in assets, which means they don't have 8,000 employees working for them and so forth. Their accounts team is very small. It's very small. I'm comfortable with that. It just means that, you know, taking hundreds and hundreds of people to come in, that's going to take them a little bit while longer. And they are very careful and diligent, and I've appreciated the diligence that they've had so far. But just please, all I ask is that you be patient. And they're very systematically working down a list. All I ask is that you be patient with that. Was also very happy to bring you a really great Italian citizenship option. A lot of folks, we got a lot of really great feedback from people about that. Marco is a really great guy, our attorney there in Italy, and has a really great program. Again, if you want to do this fast track option, it might be something that's beneficial for a lot of folks, and help you get that passport much, much more quickly. and is something that I think a lot of folks might actually end up finding that they might qualify for if you can sort of match the chain, and they have people there who, you know, who are on the ground and willing to go and do that paperwork for you. You should have received by now, hopefully it might be in your inbox because my team just sent this out the other day, is another IRA update. I felt it was important. We had a lot of folks lately going through and setting up self-directed IRAs, and I wanted to make sure that you had some additional guidance out there about prohibited transactions. This is a big deal for the Internal Revenue Service, so we go into a lot of detail about prohibited transactions and how the funds are supposed to flow and so forth. So very useful information. If you have a self-directed IRA, you're interested in a self-directed IRA, definitely want to recommend that you check that out. I will be leaving Asia next week, heading back to Europe, spending another month and a half or so in Europe. Have a lot of interesting plans. We'll be not just in Europe, but also traveling around in Africa and the Middle East as well. So, you know, a lot of really cool stuff to come down the road from that. I want to go ahead and get into questions here. I'm just going to blow through these as quickly as I can. We had one reader ask us, hey, I heard there's a foreign currency purchase tax of 1% on all wires basically coming out of Bermuda. You know, is that the case? That's not the case. If you're changing money in and out of Bermuda dollars, then yeah, there's some 1% surcharge. There's a small tax on that. I don't recommend that you hold Bermuda dollars. There's no reason to hold Bermuda dollars. You can hold any other currency you want. You know, you can hold U.S. dollars. Bermuda dollars is essentially, you know, is basically pegged as well. So it's not going to do you any good to hold Bermuda dollars, in my opinion. So if you don't hold Bermuda dollars, then you're not going to be subject to that tax. Dan asked a question. I'm trying to get clarity whether I need to file FinCEN Form 105 if I send a wire transfer in excess of $10,000 to a metal storage facility overseas. FinCEN Form 105 is that form that you would have to fill out at the airport if you've ever come into the United States and you get that little blue form and you have to check the box. It says, no, I have not, you know, I don't have more than $10,000 in currency. If you do, then you have to fill out FinCEN Form 105. FinCEN Form 105 is for physical cash currency transactions. If you have more than $10,000 and so forth in physical cash, if you're doing anything in terms of physical cash with $10,000, that's when you need to fill out FinCEN Form 105. The banks would fill out FinCEN Form 104, and casinos would fill out FinCEN Form 103. All the same stuff, but basically, if you're sending a wire transfer overseas, no, you do not have to fill out for FinCEN 105 because it's not a physical cash currency transaction. Let's see, we had a reader asking about Italian citizenship, says, my parents were born in the U.S., my grandparents immigrated from Italy and became U.S. citizens. Does that mean that, this is for the reader's wife. So he said, my wife's parents were born in the U.S., my wife's grandparents immigrated from Italy and became U.S. citizens. Does that mean, you know, can my wife acquire U.S. citizenship? If so, can I acquire U.S. citizenship? The short answer is, you remember, you have to be able to prove that, you know, your parents, how did Marco put this? Essentially, you have to be able to prove that your parents were born before her grandparents might have renounced their Italian citizenship. So if that was the case, then the parents were born Italian citizens. And you can work that back several generations. This is why I think most people, a lot of people probably might actually qualify for this without even realizing it. So it's definitely worth speaking to Marco, the attorney that we mentioned, about this. And bottom line is, if your wife is eligible and becomes a citizen, then you as a spouse would also become eligible for Italian citizenship, depending on how long you've been married. But that's definitely a possibility. So if you think there's any chance at all, you know, and you have some Italian ancestry and you have some basic clue about where your family came from, and if you just say, oh, I think I had a great-grandfather from, you know, somewhere in Sicily, that's not really going to do them any good. But if you know names and relative birth dates and kind of towns and regions and so forth, then they'll be able to actually go and look at the paperwork and be able to give you a pretty good idea. Once they find the paperwork, they'll be able to tell you for sure either you qualify or not. So it's definitely worth, it's probably worth a little bit of time and money to look into that. Let's see. Well, we've got one person who asked me, about where I can buy a vehicle in Chile. Well, you know, at a car dealership, they have car dealerships in Chile. There's a whole lot of them in Vitacura. That's where I always get mine. I just bought a Volvo. I'm actually quite happy with it. So after the car wreck that I got in, I don't know if I told you guys this, but I was in the vehicle. I used to have a Hyundai Santa Fe, and the airbags didn't deploy. So we crashed in. This is, I talked about my car accident a couple months ago. And the crash is probably at, we're probably going 40, 50 miles an hour upon impact. And the airbags did not deploy. I couldn't believe it. We all had our seatbelts on, and, you know, there's other safety features in the vehicle, obviously. After that, when the airbags didn't deploy, I thought, okay, I'm not driving this car anymore. So I just went and bought a Volvo. And I bought that in Vitacura. I bought the Hyundai in Vitacura. So there's a lot of car dealerships in Vitacura. If you want a used car, you can look at stuff online on, MercadoLibre.cl. This is a place. It's all in Spanish, but you can use a translator. What else? If you're Facebook inclined, Facebook actually has a couple of expat websites. You know, they call it like Gringo Garage Sale, Gringos Selling Stuff, whatever. And occasionally you see guys selling cars and things like that on there. I've seen some actually fairly attractive deals on that. Bottom line is, if there's folks that find they might need help, I have staff on the ground in Chile. So if you really need help with something, like if you don't speak Spanish, need somebody to kind of play some calls for you, I could probably get some folks on my staff to do that. I would need to charge you for their time, obviously, but we would be able to help you out with stuff like that if you really needed it. Let's see. We have this is a great question. We have a reader that says, I've seen online that you can purchase citizenship in, drumroll please, Vanuatu, for $10,000 and a $270,000 investment. Is this a legitimate program? Well, sort of. That's the answer. I would say no. As a person of integrity, I'm just going to say no. And the reason why is that technically there is a law on the books in Vanuatu. There's actually a whole bunch of laws and regulations on the books. Vanuatu has something called the Capital Investment Immigration Plan, or CIIP. This has been on the books for a little while, and it's basically a program where you can invest some money, become a resident, and very quickly thereafter obtain citizenship. And you might be thinking to yourself, hey, Simon Black, you're supposed to be the guy telling me about this stuff. Why haven't you ever told me about the Capital Investment Immigration Plan in Vanuatu? Well, that's because I have very little respect for the government in Vanuatu, having dealt with them so many times in the past. I have done every deal you can imagine with the government in Vanuatu. Just to give you an idea of how unstable the law is, the Capital Investment Immigration Plan, they've modified it 12 times in the last 2 years alone. Every time they modify it, they change the amount of money, they change the terms, they change the whole thing. You know, it's they pass a new law, it says strike this, insert that, eliminate 170,000, make it 260, take out 260, make it 90. There's no consistency with this government at all. It's a cultural issue. It's typical of islands. The law itself, actually in the law, they have all sorts of expedition fees. If you want it in 9 months, then you pay this. If you want it in 3 months and you pay that, you pay all this extra. You forgive the debt. You pay 25% more. And this stuff, literally, it changes. It's changed 12 times in 2 years. This is not a credible law. There's a couple of huge smoking guns here. One is that in one of the laws, the president authorized himself to grant honorary citizenship to anybody that he felt in his sole discretion was worthy. In a place like Vanuatu, this is a privilege that most heads of state have. In a place like Vanuatu, this is a place that's just wide open for abuse, which of course has happened. And I've dealt with this sort of thing a lot, where you wouldn't believe the number of people that have offered me deals and getting people set up with passports and those sorts of things. You probably realize by now I'm not that kind of guy. If you're looking for people online who are willing to sell you, you know, fraudulent or, you know, or illegitimate or, you know, ill-gotten passports. There's plenty of other websites out there who are willing to do that, who are willing to take your money and have absolutely no morals whatsoever about doing that. I think it's a waste. I think it's a BS passport. And the other thing I was going to tell you about, in the law itself, it says that that investing actually only gives you the right to apply for citizenship. It doesn't actually give you the citizenship. It gives you the right to apply within X number of months, 3 months, 9 months, if you pay more and so forth. It only gives you the right to apply. It doesn't actually guarantee when you're going to have a document in your hand. And if you've dealt in the islands very much, you understand that that just opens you up to a whole new set of skids to grease, a lot of palms out, wanting more money. In the islands, they call this the big man concept. It's a completely acceptable way of doing business, particularly in those sorts of cultures. It's very prevalent. I'm not making a judgment call on their culture so much. It's just not one that I particularly care to deal with, and not one that I think has any modicum of stability in which one should invest his or her time in investigating. And on the balance, particularly with the prices involved and so forth, although they tend to go up and down all the time with this Vanuatu program, I don't think that the passport is the quality of the passport really merits the price tag involved and the risk level and so forth. So that's my take on it. That's why you haven't really heard of it from me, because I just don't think it's credible. And anytime you hear something that's going to come out of my mouth, it's going to be something that I believe is credible and in the best interest of our members. Question about FATCA from Julian wants to know if an Uruguayan or Chilean citizen, somebody who's not a U.S. citizen, wants to wire money from his or her bank in his or her respective country to an account in another country. Let's say you're a Chilean citizen and you want to wire money from Chile to Uruguay. And let's say that money happens to, you know, go through the United States. Is that Chilean citizen subject to the 30% withholding as well, assuming that the receiving bank is not FATCA compliant? The answer to that question is yes. If the receiving bank is not FATCA compliant, it could be subject to withholding. It's not about if the recipient of the funds is a U.S. citizen. It's really about the bank, which bank is compliant, which banks are not compliant. And if a bank's not compliant, it's definitely a strong possibility that it would be that those funds would be withheld. This is a question from John, who misunderstood something that I must have mentioned on a previous conference call. He said, "Simon, you made a comment about the Norwegian krone being a cockroach currency. Can you please explain that, as I'm considering holding this currency in my bank account?" This wasn't a dig against the krone at all. When I said cockroach currency, I meant, if you think about, you know, what animal species in the world is the species that above anything else has been around for eons and eons, has been able to withstand every possible natural disaster, human disaster, overpopulations and nuclear, everything? It's a cockroach. I mean, that's the fact of the matter. There's actually other species that are even more resilient than the cockroach, but the cockroach is fairly well known. You know, the joke being that if there were, you know, nuclear war, and the entire Earth were obliterated, cockroaches would still be, you know, walking around the Earth, simply because they have that kind of staying power. That's the Norwegian krone. Simply by looking at the fundamentals, you've got a central bank that has an enormous margin of safety. You've got a government that's in a massive positive financial position, zero net debt in Norway. Everything about the krone screams safety. And so because of that, again, I say if there were some, financial nuclear meltdown, that the only currency left standing would be the cockroach currency, and that's the Norwegian krone. I don't mean that as a dig. I mean that really as a compliment to the krone. If there is a paper currency that is stronger than all the rest, it is the krone. And that's not my conjecture. That's a data-driven conclusion. Question from readers. A reader asks, basically, I'm not a U.S. citizen. I have opened an account. I've got a Marshall Islands company. I've opened up a bank account in the United States. I'm going to be doing a lot of business there. It's not a U.S. company. It's not doing business in the U.S. It's just a bank account in the U.S. Is this going to be a problem, particularly if the company starts receiving, you know, six-figure, seven-figure deposits? You know, is that going to be a problem? Am I going to have to pay taxes and so forth? you know, look, here's my view. Actually, the reader says the only reason I have this account is so I have access to the credit card processors in the United States, because I have to be able to process credit card transactions. You know, here's my take. One, I wouldn't, without knowing anything about the business, I would be doing you a disservice if I tried to give you any kind of tax commentary at all and say, oh yeah, sure, you're subject to tax or not subject to tax. Generally speaking, though, just having a financial account in a country does not necessarily make you or your business a tax resident in that country. And that certainly goes for the United States as well, because after all, the United States is the number one offshore jurisdiction in the world. It's the number one tax haven. It's a place where every non-U.S. person wants to go and put money and set up Delaware companies and all this in the United States, simply because the U.S. still has, in many degrees, quite a lot of banking privacy and banking privacy loopholes that they've managed to smash other countries out of. So they're the only game in town right now, in some respects. One option that you may find a little bit easier to deal with is if you have a company. If it's an e-commerce company or trading company, whatever you're selling, and you want to keep that company in the Marshall Islands, that's fine. Keep the intellectual property, keep the actual trading business in the Marshall Islands. And if you really want to draw a clear line, just set up a company in the U.S. that does nothing more than process credit card transactions. So, you know, set up XYZ Credit Card Processing, you know, Incorporated in the United States. Set up credit card processing facilities with all kinds of, you know, as many as you can, you know, get multiple credit card processing accounts, you know, for that U.S. company. And what the U.S. company does is does nothing more than process credit card transactions for your Marshall Islands company. And it takes a fee. So maybe, you know, whatever, 0.25%, 0.5%. Look at what's in the marketplace right now. Just for myself, obviously looking at this in the marketplace, I think that 0.25% to 0.5% is a reasonable fee. There are other companies out there doing this, and that's pretty much what they charge. They charge 0.25%, 0.5% tops. And so let's say you make $1 million, you have $1 million in sales, the credit card processing company would process all of that, all those sales, and then it would keep, let's say, 0.25%. So that would be, I'm just doing the math off the top of my head, survey says $2,500 that it would keep for itself. So the profit for XYZ Credit Card Processing Inc. would be $2,500. XYZ Processing Inc. would pay taxes on that $2,500, but the rest of the money gets paid to its client, the Marshall Islands company. I would suggest to make it even better is that you run a bona fide credit card processing company, and you can offer those same services to any client, to any customer. You know, charge anybody 0.5%, 0.25% to process their credit card transactions. And now you actually have a real, honest to goodness credit card processing business in the United States, and then you have a whatever e-commerce company, internet company, whatever you have, you know, based in the Marshall Islands, online, that's owned by a non-U.S. person, that in that case, very clearly not subject to U.S. tax. So that's, you know, that's one possible recommendation. Definitely, you know, get the right answers. Talk to a U.S. tax advisor, you know, to double check. But that may be a strategy that you would want to consider with the appropriate counsel. Just a couple left before we dash off. Oh, Anne wants to know, do I think that Italy might ever start a universal draft, demanding taxes for offshore citizens and et cetera, thus making their citizenship a liability rather than an asset? Well, they used to actually have a draft, and they got rid of it. This was something they did just a couple of years ago. When I became an Italian citizen, they still had the draft. So you can imagine, which I didn't know when I became an Italian citizen. I remember sitting in the consulate in Houston, and I had just actually gotten out of the military in the U.S. I had done all of my tours overseas, you know, and I was sitting there still with my short haircut. I had my, if you can imagine me, if you're an Army guy, if you can imagine me with a high and tight, it was pretty gruesome. And so sitting there in the consulate in Houston, and the guy comes out from the window, which of course you never see one of these consular bureaucrats come away from the window and out into the lobby. And he sat down next to me and he explained, he said, well, you have to register for the draft. And, you know, you could probably imagine the three letters that came out of my mouth next. And but we actually kind of found a way around it, and it ended up being fine. And very quickly thereafter, they discontinued the law, and they changed the law, and they said, yeah, we're going to do away with the draft entirely. It's pointless. It's useless. Italy's not going to war anymore. We're too broke to go to war. Why do we need a draft? and so they got rid of it. Demanding taxes for offshore citizens. Italy itself is an extraordinarily tax-inefficient place. They have all these crazy high taxes that nobody pays, including the politicians who write the laws. You know, it's like every other Tuesday, another politician gets caught red-handed evading taxes in Italy. And nobody seems to care because it's a national sport in Italy, as it is in Greece and Spain and so many other places, to evade taxes. So on one hand, while Italy has a tremendously high tax burden, on the other hand, the effective, I mean, the only people that are paying it are, you know, a handful of people that can't escape it, primarily, you know, wage earners and the like, but people just don't pay taxes there. The government has almost no way to really chase it all down. They're trying, but it's certainly a possibility that they would try and chase up overseas citizens. But the fact is that Italy has so many double taxation agreements. So where are... you know, where is the Italian diaspora? Where are all the overseas Italian citizens living? A lot of them are living in the United States, which has a, you know, which has a double tax treaty with Italy. So Italian citizens that are living in the United States would pay, you know, U.S. income tax and non-Italian tax. Or they're living in France, or living in Switzerland, living in the U.K., living in all these other places, each of which has a double taxation agreement with Italy. And so if Italy went, you know, how many Italians are there living in, I don't know, the Cayman Islands? Not that many. In fact, Italy already has a law on its books as part of the Italian tax code. It says, if you're an Italian citizen living overseas, you don't have to, you know, you don't have to pay Italian tax anymore. You pay local tax. But if you're an Italian citizen living overseas in a place that we believe to be a tax haven, including Panama and Seychelles and, you know, Dubai and so forth, if that's what you're going to tell us is your official residence, then that's fine. But we want you to actually prove to us that you're really living there. You know, what they're basically trying to, you know, ensure is that people don't just put down on paper, yeah, I'm living in Panama, but they're really, you know, living in Lugano or whatever, and then they're just telling the government that they live in Panama. So they want you to actually demonstrate, if you're living in a tax haven, that you do live there. So the bottom line is that if Italy, so they already got rid of the draft, and if they actually did go out and say, we want money from all our offshore citizens, they would have to undo a whole lot of bilateral, multilateral treaties that they've already signed, which is a very difficult thing. And anything is possible. I'm never going to say, you know, things are impossible. I think there's just so many steps that the Italians would take before they would even get to that point. I think things would get much more draconian. You know, the low-hanging tax fruit for them is in their own country. You know, not trying to go around and and find guys that are living in Panama or whatever and trying to tax those guys. It's not going to be very meaningful for them in terms of moving the needle. So I think before they get to that, Italy's going to confiscate bank accounts. They're going to grab pension funds. They're going to do all those typical things that they do, because it's just a question of what's the size of the market, right? What's the size of the market in terms of Italians living overseas, in terms of the tax funds they would actually be able to grab, versus, you know, just being able to confiscate assets in Italy. It's a much easier thing for them to do, to just confiscate assets in Italy. So that's my take on it. Let's see. I think that's really the last one. We've got a few more I wasn't able to get to, but I actually have to run. I've got some folks that are waiting on me, and I know everybody's probably got a busy day ahead of them, so we'll just roll some of the ones I didn't get to into next month's teleconference. Listen, I just want to make a final point. I sent you guys a note last week, I guess it was. It was the 5-year anniversary of Sovereign Man. I just want to say thanks once again. It's members of Sovereign Man Confidential are really the reason why we're able to have Sovereign Man. Sovereign Man Confidential is the cornerstone of Sovereign Man. We started this 5 years ago. We launched Sovereign Man Confidential 4 years ago. It's been a phenomenal experience. It's been an honor to be able to spend the vast majority of my days thinking about this, trying to create as much value as possible. If you're just joining us for the first time as a new member, I want to say welcome. Thank you for joining us. This is a tremendous journey. And again, we have a front row seat to witness one of the great unravelings of all time. And even if I happen to be completely and totally wrong, and even if it turns out that there's absolutely no consequences to conjuring trillions of dollars out of thin air and going into debt, tens of trillions of dollars and so forth, even if I'm completely wrong about the negative consequences, I'm still proud to say that the things that we talk about are still very important because you're not going to be worse off for doing these things. You're not going to be worse off because you put money in a strong and stable bank, and because you set up a self-directed IRA and you apply for residency overseas, all these sorts of things. These are things that make sense in any scenario, and I'm incredibly pleased to be able to be part of that journey with you. And I just want to say thanks to everybody that's been a part of us. I want to say welcome to the new members that we have, and how much I look forward to continuing this journey with you in the months and the years to come. So with that, I'd like to sign off, and we'll talk to you again soon. You take care.